I'm Robert Cervelli, and this is Future Proofing, where we explore how many communities are taking charge of their own future in the face of our increasingly fragile world. I would like to acknowledge that this podcast originates from Nova Scotia, Canada, which is part of the unceded ancestral territory of the Mi'kmaq Indigenous peoples. The territory is called Mi'kma'ki.
So I would like to welcome my mentor and good friend, Mark Anielski, on the Center for Local Prosperity podcast. The last couple of podcasts we've been having were around our Dig-In Food Security Food Sovereignty Summit. But, you know, the entire point of Center for Local Prosperity is how are we building prosperity locally? We have a, you know, we have a focus on working, you know, a lot with rural groups. And so the reason I wanted to talk to Mark today, besides the fact that I just always really enjoy talking to Mark, is that Mark is always working sort of at the edge of where we are working in that entire sustainability world. And so I'm just going to say a little bit about Mark. Mark is the president and chief well-being officer of Anielski Management, which is an economic consultancy specializing in the economics of happiness and well-being, which with what's going on in the world, I would say Mark is becoming much more of a focus for people. As a chief well-being economist with Indigenomics Institute that he founded with Carol Ann Hilton as well. And I think we're going to be talking a little bit more about that. And one of the things I always appreciate about Mark is that you bring a unique and practical approach to measuring progress, well-being, and actually digging into what's really important to measure versus, you know, what our traditional economic measures actually collect and trend and, you know, think are important. And so Mark also, when I met him, was the head of the Canadian Society for Ecological Economics. And my first conversation with you, Mark, and not Herman Daly, but it was, who was at the Jasper event?
John Cobb.
John Cobbs. I met the two of my favorite ecological economists at one place. And that was it. After that, I just started following Mark around everywhere.
and Herman just passed away. So
I know.
Well, in October, I guess.
Yeah, I know. So Mark, my fascinating part about my conversations with you is that I think we're heading in one direction and then we end up in the most fascinating other direction. So I thought I would just start with, can you tell our audience, which is largely Atlantic Canadian, some of the work, you're based in Edmonton, and just what is the, you've been working on some really interesting things. And I know you were just telling me about a fascinating new piece that is happening. And maybe we could get into that so we could, our audience can see what can happen, what could happen.
Right. Well, thanks, Jillian. And yes, we've been friends for a long time. And we share a kind of common vocation of ecological economics. And my work was as a forest economist with many years ago at the Alberta Forest Service, and then being in the finance ministry, treasury, when Ralph Klein was premier, you know, struck me that we weren't measuring, you know, even the Treasury Board, you know, when you thought about it, it's like, were they ever talking about how they could stimulate GDP? No, they weren't, even though we kept using that measure progress. And it was in 1997 in my Dilbert cubicle in Treasury that, you know, came across this report by Redefining Progress in San Francisco, a really amazing economic think tank. And they had come up with this new way of measuring well-being called the Genuine Progress Index. And, you know, from that moment on, I decided I would dedicate or try to kind of develop this for Canada. And then met Ron Coleman, who was GPI Atlantic in Halifax, who was also leading, kind of also got excited about this GPI idea and did some remarkable work in Nova Scotia. So I have had long connections with Nova Scotia. And in fact, my book launch, my first book reading launch was at the Wooden Monkey in Lil McPherson's restaurant in downtown Halifax. And it was a Mi'kmaq elder. I know I always go off on tangents, but there was a Mi'kmaq elder there who actually was weeping and said, this is a fulfillment of the legend of the eagle and condor coming together, the North and the South, Turtle Island of the North America and South America. So I thought, I don't know what's going on here. That was 2007. And then they thought my book predicted the collapse, the financial collapse 2008. And I said, no, I didn't. I'm not a soothsayer. But whatever we're doing here, we're talking about happiness and well-being, is striking a deep chord inside all of us that kind of makes, it's just common sense, right? Well, of course, why wouldn't we pursue well-being? And what is well-being? And I discovered in that journey in writing the book with which was encouraged by my MBA students at Bainbridge Graduate Institute in Seattle area, first MBA in sustainability, that they told me to write the book. And I didn't want to write the book. And I thought, well, let's just sit down like we're doing now through, you know, with a microphone and a few pitchers of beer, and we'll have a Socratic dialogue, right? The old school. And that was kind of the spirit of the book. And from there, like the book, the idea of, well, how do we account for well-being, and what is well-being, and what is wealth? The word wealth comes from the old English, the conditions of well-being, that's what it means. And I was blown away. And happiness is well-being of your soul, or well-being of spirit, from the Greek, from Aristotle. So with my accounting background, economics background, I started to conceive of a different accounting model. How would we measure the genuine wealth of nations? And genuine meaning we're aligned with their values. So what are core values? What is virtue? As I would teach my business students at U of A, what is virtue? And over the years, started to get connected to First Nations work and my first project in Nunavut, when I was still director of the Pemina Institute, asked me to come up and develop a state of well-being and culture report, indicators of well-being. And I said, I think we need to sit with the elders, the Innu elders, and ask them to confirm the core values of Inuit. And from there, I realized, whatever we're measuring, we got to link to the core values of our culture, whatever they are. And it turns out there are kind of seven sacred teachings or laws in Indigenous, whether you're Anishinaabe, your Mi'kmaq, your Cree or Dene, or your Haudenosaunee, the first peoples, the sacred fire keepers, the Haudenosaunee, the Iroquois Confederacy, seven sacred teachings, which begin with humility and end with love. So, well, how do we design a system of accounting or finance, banking, you know, sovereign wealth funds? And so that's what I'm working on now, is like, let's stand up something more compelling. As Buckminster Fuller said, how are we going to change a system? By designing something more compelling than the current one. And so it's exciting, and it's going back to ancient kind of teachings that haven't been extinguished on Turtle Island, still here. And even if the colonizer try to suppress and destroy those cultures, that ancient wisdom, still alive in Mi'kmaq, cultures in Haligonia, right, Nova Scotia, New Scotland.
Anyways. Well, and Mark, so specific, I mean, the journey, you know, we've been talking about this for a few years, the work you've been doing with different Indigenous groups, or, you know, the partnerships, but you've also been looking at trying to transform the monetary system, right? Like the way that we do business. And so I'd be really intrigued to see I think you have a meeting this afternoon, so I think there's a lot on the go. So maybe talk about why it needs to be transformed, and then, you know, sort of maybe what work you're working on now to look at transforming that.
Yeah. So I remember sitting in when I first met Herman Daly in 1999, when I was doing the U.S. Genuine Progress Indicator update, I insisted I go to Washington and meet with, you know, World Bank and IMF and Herman Daly, who was my mentor. And he said, Mark, this is the most important. Your inquiry into the money system is the most, more important than anything in sustainability. And I said, oh, and I had already been studying banking and like, what is money? How is it created? But when Herman said that, he said, there's a direct connection between economic growth and debt money. And I said, oh, that's interesting. Let's look at the data. Let's look at the empirical connection between the two. So it turns out that GDP is directly correlated with the increasing levels of debt, monetary debt. And when you ask the question, well, how is the money created in our system? And even Mark Carney, who was from Edmonton, who became the Bank of England, Bank of Canada governor, and then Bank of England, affirmed about 5 years ago, indeed, private banks create 98% of the money supply when they issue loans. What did you just say? 98% money is created by private corporations when they issue a mortgage, which means a death pledge, a car loan, a student loan, and even when they buy government debt or bonds. So banks have enormous power. They're corporations with enormous responsibility. Could banks create loans tied to well-being? Don't know. Why not? So this has been my supposition. And the problem with debt money is that debt continue to grow as we see the notion of compounding interest. So you see, since World War II, the amount of debt in the United States has been doubling every 7 years, roughly 7 to 8 years. Never forgiven, as they would have done in ancient times, Samaria, ancient Israel, called the Jubilee Law. So we've had 70, 80 years of compounded interest. And this is not just the US, this is globally, where there's no what they would call a clean slate or re-forgiveness of the debts. So the problem with that is that the debt money demands interest payments. And it doesn't matter how low the interest rates are, as long as the debt keeps growing, you're going to cannibalize the real economy. So what is the hidden interest what are the hidden interest costs in the price of your Starbucks latte today? It doesn't show up on your receipt, but it's big. So my estimates of, half of American and Canadian household income now is going to pay for hidden interest charges on the debt. And COVID added another $500 billion on top of $700 billion that preceded COVID. $500 billion was added in 18 months. And nobody blinks an eye and says, well, where did the money come from? Did the Bank of Canada create the money? Did Chrystia Freeland? Nobody wants to talk about it. And I'm like, well, wait a minute. We had the equivalent of a war, and we created money surprisingly, magically, out of nothing. And who's going to pay back? How are we going to pay back that debt? Who holds the debt? So my whole supposition is, let's create an accounting system, central banking, public banking, that ties creation of money to the well-being accounts of nation, the well-being of accounts of, Halifax or Nova Scotia. Finance treasury boards start to think about every time we're going to run a deficit and have to paper a bond to balance the budget, can we now issue, instead of a debt bond, a well-being bond? Can we be creative in finance to create new financial? So I'm not talking revolutionary. I'm talking about using the existing system creatively. We have green bonds, supposedly. What's the term of a green bond? What's its objective? How does it verify that, in fact, carbon liabilities have, in fact, been reduced? How do you verify? I'm a forester. How do you verify that actually happened? Can we create well-being bonds? Yes, we can. We're very clear term sheets. And then when we invest in those instruments, we know, like, okay, we expect an actually quantifiable well-being impact, right, from the investment. And we can measure that, we can verify that, we can ask people how they feel, how they experience well-being. Are they depressed? Are they joyful? Are they hopeful? You can quantify all those things. That's, again, what I'm working on. And why not with First Nations? Why? Because no one else seems to be, everyone else is either asleep or lacks imagination. And these First Peoples, they use wampum, they use seashells for money. They had elaborate protocols of consensus building and governance, clan mothers, matrilineal structures, complex systems of decision-making that would make us feel very frustrated because it would take hours to discuss well-being. Anyways, I'm just blathering on, but I'm just giving you a narrative of something that I've only learned. I didn't learn any of this at the University of Alberta or in the government of Alberta, So.
Mark, what are the biggest, so you talked about some of the challenges being a lack of imagination, but are there people actively working against this? Who would be the biggest people, I guess, who would be the biggest losers if we were to move to a system of well-being or an accounting system of well-being or a bank of well-being?
I told Damona Forte when she was associate finance minister assigned by Trudeau to a portfolio of measuring quality of life and integrating well-being into the Canadian budgeting system. It blew me away. That was in the middle of COVID that I got a call from her chief of staff. And I said, there's nobody opposed. I mean, if Jacinda Ardern can do it in New Zealand, right? And work closely with the Maori, who then actually succeeded in defining the river as a mother, as a third person in the relationship with the Maori and the New Zealand government, mm-hmm. Then who's opposed to this? This is just, I said, it's only a matter of time till a Canadian river gets defined as a person, as a grandmother as well. Who would be most at risk? Well, of course, anyone who, if we eliminated debt overnight, and we're not going to do that overnight, but if you were to extinguish the $1.2 trillion of debt that is owing, right, just from Canada alone, I said, the only one that would be a loser in this are those bondholders that bought the COVID, I call them COVID bonds, for example, that are now holding them. Now, what's interesting, we pointed out, was the Bank of Canada was buying most of those bonds. What does that mean? It's our bank. So who are we paying interest to? Our own, ourselves. You know, when World War II happened, we sold war bonds and Canadians bought them dutifully, and they were willing to not make any money on those bonds. And then we wrote off those bonds, right? 10 years later, we said, the war's over. So will we have the same courage this time to say, we'll write the bonds off? The COVID is whenever it's over, you know, how do we write them off? Simple, as easy as it was to create the bond with a signature of Chrystia Freeland. That's how easy it is. I know, because I sat on the Audit Committee of Alberta and I would ask those questions. And politicians are like, what are you talking about? It's like, look, the controller just told us how easy it is to create the instrument. Therefore, it should be relatively easy to negate it. But you create instruments only when you're in absolute need. Why are you running deficits in the first place? No need to run a deficit. But you're like, well, when did we start running deficits? 1974, when Trudeau came back from Basel, Switzerland. And they agreed, all the leaders agreed that governments could sell debt bonds to the private sector. So guess, you look at the evidence, they started running deficits after 74. There was no deficits before then. Rarely. Since World War II, you look at the financial statements of the government, didn't run deficits.
Is this at all, and this is not, the gold standard happened in the 60s, didn't it? With the I know this is a different system, but was the gold standard when the US took the monetary system 19, off?
1971.
Okay, so 70s.
And my argument is, you know, I could do a historical here. If you actually look at what's going on with the war in the Ukraine, you can see what's going on with Russia and China and India and Iran. They want to go back to what Keynes argued for at the Bretton Woods. He said, we actually need a resource-backed currency. So in other words, tied to something, not just gold necessarily, but oil and other real commodities that are materially important to the economy. But the US won that argument, and so US has been dominating the debt money system ever since, the petrodollar. And in 1971, Nixon realized they couldn't fulfill the demand payment of gold. You know, it was something like 28 grams of gold per dollar or something like that. So this is what it's interesting, because we're kind of in an economic war right now. It's not just a military battle, it's a financial war, and some countries want to go to that vision Keynes had. And that's what I'm arguing. What if you had a currency that was actually backed by tangible, fungible assets? You know, you could say, well, oil, we want to burn less oil. That's fine, of course. But what are the material aspects of a well-being lifestyle? You know, living locally, you know, your work. Why don't we have an account of the viability, integrity, the health of the soils in Nova Scotia, and then figure out what's the optimum kind of output we can generate, and then finance that optimum output? Why are we trading all of our surplus away instead of thinking, well, how locally can we live? Not because we want to be isolated, because we actually, in times of crisis, we know we can be resilient. We know we can feed each other and warm our homes. We never have enough wood, standing timber to heat our homes when pipelines, you know, stop, whatever. Those are the kind of economic strategies. They're just common sense, but we operate without a balance sheet. It's my point of governments. Like, I'm not talking crazy stuff. I'm saying, you know, a good balance sheet is what Warren Buffett likes to see. But there's no balance sheet for Nova Scotia, no full balance sheet. And that's really important, because I'm just talking basic accounting, 500 years of accounting tradition that has been effectively ignored or violated by governments.
So, and Mark, I think, as you said, with the Center for Local Prosperity, the work that we've been, you know, that Bob, our executive director, and the team have been working on is really at that local level. Like, we live in a system of, you know, the monetary system. We live in a system of, you know, of loans and debts and all the rest of it. So, and you are familiar with Nova Scotia. Obviously, you've been here many times. Is there any advice that you would give? And again, our audience is pretty broad, but like, we're working with communities and organizational groups about how, even though the system is large and cumbersome, and you know, it's like the Titanic, right? It's gonna take a long time to turn. What kind of advice would you give for local actors that are truly trying to make our communities resilient, make sure that we are working on, you know, building increasing well-being, and making sure that we are, I know sustainability is overused, but we're, you know, it's a sustainable model.
Yeah. Well, it's a great question. And, you know, I'm part of the Public Banking Associates in the US, and Ellen Brown was from Los Angeles, one of the big champions of public banking as a lawyer. And so we've been trying to, the US is, so we have this model of a public bank called Alberta Treasury Branch, which was founded in 1938 when Alberta was bankrupt, technically bankrupt. And Eberhard at the time said, well, why don't we create our own money, right? And of course, the Eastern Bank shut that down within a year. So you can't go rogue. You cannot print your own money. But we had something else as a legacy, which was the Alberta Treasury Branch, which effectively is Alberta's bank, 100% backed by the assets of the province. Legally doesn't, by law, doesn't need to generate a profit. That means we have our own credit facility. Well, why doesn't every other province have that? So here's some interesting news, maybe cat out of the bag. I got a call from the senior financial policy guy of the Ontario NDP party, right? We're reading your papers on ATB and Bank of North Dakota. And that's what I'm trying to do with the First Nations now. It's like, create your own public bank, membership owned, 100% owned by the citizens and members of a nation, so that we all participate in the benefits of having a bank. What does a public bank do? It creates, has financial services for the citizens of a province. If you live in Ontario, you cannot be an ATB account holder. Bank of North Dakota, the biggest public bank in America, in North Dakota, it's founded before ATB, 1919, also provides loans to the state, infrastructure loans, borrows from the Fed through the Federal Reserve window at 0.25%, lends money to the state or to other commercial community banks or credit unions at, say, 2%. So it's still making a healthy margin. Doesn't have to generate a profit because that's not its mandate. So these are the ideas that we can bring forward at any scale, whether it's municipal or provincial. So why does Nova Scotia have a public bank? And I've had these conversations, I don't care, with Daniel Smith when she was still a leader of the Wild Rose, you know, and then our talk show. I said, Daniel, what, you know, she said, well, why didn't we sell ATB? It's like, why would you sell our own bank? To who? Shake your head, Daniel. Now she's premier. And the same with Rachel Notley, who's my backdoor neighbor. I had the same conversation. So, Rachel, you know, we have the best kept secret in all of North America. Our bank, our ATB, is 10 times bigger than the Bank of North Dakota. And I'm like, the only question is, why aren't we issuing at cost loans to all Albertans? What does it mean, at cost? You're just recovering your operating costs because you don't have a mandate to generate profits. What's the cost of creating a mortgage and managing it from the beginning to end? Nobody can tell you because no one's done the math. And my supposition is, I bet you it's less than 2%. So let's offer mortgages to Albertans, especially low-income Albertans, right? Who at 1%, because that's all it costs us to create it, especially in a technical fintech future. We don't need branches. We don't even need buildings. So these are kind of the creative things. Like, if you put them out there and people go, you know what the often response is? Oh, that's really nice, Mark. It's too complicated. It's too political. Who's going to bully you? Who's first going to say, you're putting my cookie, my piggy bank or cookie jar at risk. Well, the commercial banks, of course. Mm. This is the problem with public banks too, because, and I don't want to shut down RBC and TD, and I'm not saying that. They play a really important role. But when you have the potential of both a public bank and a commercial credit banks, credit unions that could work together with the central bank, then we have not used our full imagination. At the most important inflection point, I think, in our human journey for the last 7 years.
And are you hopeful? Like I know there's, you've got some things underway right now. So are you hopeful that the shift, the paradigm shift is nigh?
I'm always hopeful. I told the chiefs here, it's like, you know, all you need is $5 million to start a bank. We're tiny. We've got nations of 400 members. Lots of money though. Lots of settlement funds coming in. We've got residential school settlement funds. We've got, you know, cows and plows. We've got, you know, resource sharing benefits, which they never benefited from, advising the Robinson-Huron treaty case, right, in Ontario. You know, they were just too nice. They didn't share in the royalties. I was like, you've got all of this demand payment compensation that could just oxygenate, create this massive equity investment in your bank or your sovereign wealth fund. Got some nations that have bigger sovereign wealth funds per capita than Norway or Singapore. Right now in Canada, James Bay Cree. Talk to Matthew Kumkom. Ask him how big their sovereign wealth fund is, right? Mm. And so it's like, for a very little amount, you could start a bank, your own bank. Maybe not, you don't even call it a bank. Maybe that's too big of a word. It's too legally complex. Then start a trust, less legally onerous.
Yeah.
That's what I told you. Borrow from a low finance source, like First Nations Financial Management Board at 1%. And then, you know, buy off that debt that you're, right? A lot of these nations are in big financial trouble. They've got 23%, you know, line of credit. Pay that off. And then once you have this bank, what are the ratios of loans to equity? They're about 20 to 1. That's legal. I can issue 20 times what I have in equity in the bank. And where does the equity come from? From the nation itself, and then from members who then are shareholders of the bank, and they also are beneficiaries. They actually could get dividends, right? And once I do that, once I do one of these in all of Canada, it'll be a prairie grass fire. It'll just go. And guess what? It'd be you and I would be like, I want to be a member of that nation. Because I'm tired of getting gouged in fees and services. I'm lucky if I make 5% of my investment portfolio over 30 years, right? I'm not saying we want just chase returns again, but I want well-being. I want the land to be as fertile as possible. I want the plants and medicines that those people still remember, mm-hmm. not just high-grading timber and maximizing allowable cut. That's what I want. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So although that's possible within our lifetime, literally within a few months, we just have to stand it up. Now, oftentimes it's people's just like, it's their lack of belief, right? Because we're so colonized, we're so like conditioned to go, well, that's a scary world. I don't know anything about finance. It's daunting. Well, like there must be a lot of risk associated with having a bank. Hmm. And I said, what do you think the risk is? The risk is that every one of your clients is in default. Non-performing loan. That's not going to happen. Because guess what? We're going to put protocols. We're going to help people write good business plans. We want people to succeed. We don't want people to fail. Mm. And we can build a culture like that. So that's what I get excited. I wake up every morning and go, let's go. Come on. Like, what are we, you know?
Well, and I'll be back out west in the springtime, so I'll be definitely taking. We'll be going to the Sugar Bowl to dig into this further.
Indeed,
for sure.
And it starts. You know, it's a lot of the start of the Sugar Bowl.
I know. Thank God for the Sugar Bowl. If you get to Edmonton, go to the Sugar Bowl.
Yeah.
And Mark, it's interesting because I did a podcast last week which failed. I somehow didn't record it properly, so I'm going to be redoing it. But with Linda Best, who who set up, was one of the initial people with FarmWorks, which is basically microlending for farms. And they've had massive success because it is a community-based process where we are working together, where, you know, the learning, the, you know, best practices are being shared, you know, throughout the farming community. And, you know, when, for the last 5 years, it's been a net loss for Nova Scotia farmers, like, and not necessarily that we've been the worst of all the other Atlantic provinces, but like a net loss. We have farmers now that are going to have to like sell their land. And like, and so like, this is the opposite of what we're looking for. So things like FarmWorks and the work that you're working on, I'm looking forward to the next couple of months to see what happens. But I know we're at just about that 30 minutes. So this is the CLP podcast, but I did want to say to our audience that Mark, if you want to know a bit more about Mark, we'll make sure we put links to his website. But then also, I wanted just to mention Mark's books, because I don't know if you actually said the titles to them, but I think I've been at both book launches. And the first one is The Economics of Happiness. That was the first one. And the next one was An Economy of Well-Being, Genuine Wealth and Happiness. And I would just encourage people, whether you know, audiobook things or, you know, the library, or you want to buy a copy of it. For me, I use them in my economics classes, right? Like it's practical information. But what Mark has done is said, we're going to lift the veil of what we've been told and what we believe to be true and what we believe to be the only model, and kind of turning it up on its head and saying, well, let's just base everything on well-being and happiness and what really matters versus, you know, what we've been told to by, I don't know, by the government or by the Treasury Board or by, you know,
by our universities and our, you know, education, so-called education systems. So, yeah. You know, in fairness, we've all been, you know, I'm saying dupe, but, you know, I love the word spelling, because, you know, are we all under some type of spell? We believe the narrative. And that's what I'm talking about. And a lot of stuff I don't publish anymore. And like, because some of it's happening with respect to working with First Nations, I don't want to tell the story in gross detail. That's what I try to do in my second book. And I do have a podcast, The Economics of Well-Being, which is on all the platforms. And it's through these kind of conversations that people get, I think, inspired maybe and say, okay, so what can we do on Monday, right? It's Monday. Mm-hmm. And you can do a lot. I mean, you already mentioned you've got microfinance initiatives. You've got probably, you know, Nova Scotia is known for the cooperatives, right? Cooperative movement and Buddhist economics. And, you know, like, you've got all the right conditions there. So yeah, just keep going and you got nothing to lose.
Stay inspired.
And be pragmatic. You know, again, it's like, it would be easy to tell First Nation, oh, you know, we could have a credit facility up and standing next week. But that would also probably be irresponsible, because you want to issue loans that are actually really well, you know, constructed and, you know, tied as efficiently as you can to actual well-being, which actually is more onerous than what is now. Like, you just walk into the bank now and like, hey, Jillian, you got a job. Oh, sorry, you just quit the Conference Board of Canada. So, you're a consultant, you're high risk. Like, right. That's kind of the conditions in which you now enter into loan agreements. But, you know, I want people to walk in and say, my banker, loans officer, I'm really interested in your well-being. You know, you want to be a great muffin maker, I don't know, lobster fisherman person. Anyways.
We support it. Yeah.
Support it. And I think the exciting thing is what you're talking about is when we think about how we can become each other's banker. Oh, that's so interesting. Because really at the heart of all this is trust. It's like, I don't really trust money. I don't like my relationship with money. I don't really trust my neighbor. I don't like the banks, you know, because I just know I'm getting whatever, right? So it's about how do we engender sort of these experiences of trust where we're like, okay, if I lend you $5,000 because you need the money right now, as a bridge, right? That, you know, that the money I hope will come back at some point when it comes back. But all of those conditions of trust are so important.
And they require effort, and they require, a different set of circumstances than we're set up to go to our normal banking.
Yeah.
Mark, I would like to talk to you for many hours. Maybe we'll do a part two on this. So I just want to thank you sincerely, and please say hi to Jen. And it sounds like the whole family is doing super well. Next time you're in Nova Scotia, we'll have to get you together with some of our group and maybe meet up at the Glass Monkey.
The Wooden Monkey.
Oh, the Wooden. Yeah, sorry. Yep. I just watched Glass Onion on Netflix, so I'm distracted by all this kind of different stuff going on. But thank you, Mark.
Another plug, Silver Cameron, who interviewed me, actually, I realized at that meeting at Dalhousie in 2018, I think, he pulled me in, and Silver has since passed away, but it's called The Green Interviews, and he interviewed me at the Wooden Monkey, and it's finally up in YouTube, so it's me being like the classic fire hose. Like, of course, you're always embarrassed when you watch yourself, like, when will I ever stop talking? But
I've never had that ever said to me ever. So yeah, we're in good company.
Anyway, right, it's on YouTube. So if you want to hear more about my crazy ideas.
And that was Green what? What was it called?
Called The Green Interviews.
The Green Interviews. Okay, perfect. We'll get that written down too. Okay, sir. Well, we'll see you in Edmonton live next.
Indeed. Thanks, Jillian.
Right. Thank you. Bye.
Bye.